All right, welcome back. 239-1310. 239-1310. It's Afternoons with Amos. Candidate Tuesday continues. Today we're next Tuesday, this October the 2nd, we're going to be focusing on the House, districts 86, 87, 89, 92, and 100. Republicans will be in the first hour, Democrats in the second hour. And again, our threshold is we're picking districts that are at least 10% or more African American in the Indianapolis area. Senate District 30 includes beautiful Carmel, home of the roundabouts. Beautiful Fishers, homes of a lot of homes and apartments and the world's biggest town. It also includes nearly all of Washington Township, including the Harcourt Road Corridor, the Ditch Road Corridor, the Spring Mill Road Corridor, the Meridian Street Corridor, Nora, Keystone at the Crossing, Glendale, the Allisonville Road Corridor, the Binford Boulevard Corridor. It even delves into Meridian, Kessler, Broad Ripple, South Broad Ripple, close to Butler, a little bit of Butler-Tarkington, most of Meridian, Kessler, and it misses Rocky Ripple. The incumbent state senator is Scott Schneider, and he joins me live. Senator, welcome.
Hey, welcome. Thank you for having me.
So why are you running again?
Well, first of all, I got to say that that is the best description of our district that I've heard so far. So kudos to you. That encompasses that, just about
I
all
got
of
it.
Them.
There yeah. you go. Yeah. So why are you running again?
You know, I was a former member of the Indianapolis City Council for 8 years, mm-hmm. two four-year terms. And in 2007, I decided to call it quits. Right. Primarily because I've got five kids and work in a small family business. But I felt that I wanted to get back into at least having a say into what public policy was going on mm-hmm. Around me, and I think the thing that culminated everything in my decision to get back involved is my oldest daughter just graduated from college. Mm-hmm. I want her to be able to have an opportunity to get a job here in Indiana and not have to go along with many of our other recent high school or college graduates or post-college folks who have to go out of state to find a job. I want to be able to create an environment in Indiana where we can thrive, that the private sector can thrive, and those are the people that hire other people. And so that's what creates jobs, and that's been my first and foremost priority. And it's my biggest driving influence right now.
Senator, in your district, the areas one could consider blighted are the office parks and the retail strip malls that are vacant, that are empty, or a big box that was abandoned because somebody wanted to go to something flashier down the road. Mm-hmm. How do we regenerate those areas, to bring jobs to those areas, to fill up those office parks again, you know, to regenerate retail, maybe not a big box, but figure out how to take the big box and split it, mm-hmm. Or encourage smaller entrepreneurs. What can state government do, if anything?
Well, that's a great question. You're talking about redevelopment, mm-hmm. and how do we, as the new shiny strip malls or the new shiny office parks or the new shiny residential developments are built, there's an attraction to that, and then it leaves a vacancy. You know, I dealt with that kind of thing a lot when I was on the city council in terms of redevelopment. How do we revitalize and re-energize areas of the city? Mm-hmm. And I'll give you a prime example. Meridian Kessler area. Right. Well, there are all kinds. I don't want to single any out, mm-hmm. but they have a character unique to the neighborhood and to the area. Right. So, what do we do? How do we keep people interested in those areas instead of flashing off? You look at things like property taxes, mm-hmm. and how that impacts everybody's day to day life. When we had those property tax spikes several years ago, you know, that had a lot of people moving out. Mm-hmm. Schools. Education. You know, I've been going door to door a lot ever since the spring. Mm-hmm. One of the things that I hear, and it's an affirmation of what we already knew, mm-hmm. and what you and I have talked about for years when I was on the mm-hmm. council, and that is families will move in, and then when their kids get old enough to go to school, mm-hmm. and they're in a failing or poor school district that's not serving their needs as a family, they move out, and, mm-hmm. and And so education is critical in maintaining a vibrant neighborhood and along with property taxes. And we were able to cap those property taxes and cap them permanently in the Constitution of Indiana.
When your opponent was here, I asked him, you know, what he was hearing going door to door. And, you know, it was jobs and education. He also brought up crime. Mm-hmm. Are you hearing that if you've gone door to door, particularly in Marion County?
Sure.
How then do we deal with that given we have the property tax caps? So there's a finite amount that local government can bring in. There's obviously the city county has to make some priorities. We're understaffed with the police department, which I think if you took a vote, you know, people would, you know, want more police, but then that costs money. Mm-hmm. Do we need a change in state law to allow a city or a county to have a referendum if the people want to increase their revenue for a specific purpose? They would be allowed to do that the way schools are now allowed to do that? Or is that already in law?
Well, the framework of the property tax caps allows for a referendum for specific spending items. Mm-hmm. But I want to go back and talk about because this crime issue is sort of twofold. There are two questions. You can look at the long-term solutions to crime, mm-hmm. and that's what we have sort of a direct impact over on the state level.
Okay.
When I was on the city council and we're sort of delving into those kinds of issues, you have short-term or immediate impacts on crime that can happen on a city level.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll tell you this. One of the unfortunate criticisms of property tax caps, I think, is the fact that we talk about how, local municipalities are underfunded now.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not necessarily in agreement with that,
okay.
and I'll tell you why.
Mm-hmm.
When I was on the city council, every year that we had a budget come up, we would always say somebody on either side of the aisle will say, "Boy, you know, we're going to get by this year, but we're just going to have to do something next year."
Mm-hmm.
Without limits, the same limits that you have in your business and at home, the same limits that I have at home and all of your listeners have, you cannot take or spend more money than you take in, creates a priority list for you, and it also creates or generates creativity in how you're going to spend money, how you're going to increase revenue, and things like that. So I think those are positive things that local government can do under those thresholds, because we all know if you give government $10, it'll spend 10 and maybe even 15 that it doesn't have. And so I think those limits are good because it does create some fiscal responsibility.
But the city or the county could do a referendum for a specific purpose.
It's my understanding, and I may have to go back and go get specifically into the code, but I know education can specifically ask for a referendum that can go outside of the property tax caps. So, and we've been having the discussion on infrastructure and mass transit about a referendum for income tax.
Where do you stand on that? And the reason I say that is in the last session of the legislation, there were other issues that kind of bogged mass transit down that had nothing to do with mass transit. But the Republican senators and representatives that represented Marion County and the suburbs were kind of quiet or standoffish, and I would talk to a couple of them when we were on the air from the legislature, and they just simply said, "Wait a minute, I don't want to get positioned in a vote that could be construed as in favor of taxes." Where are you on this issue? Because this district is right in ground zero of this whole mass transit debate.
Well, when you mentioned all of the corridors that you were talking about, the Benford area corridor, I-69, is one of those that's been an issue for as long as I can remember, going back to the city council. And it's funny you mentioned that. I just had another meeting with the folks from the transportation advocates.
Mm-hmm.
Again, trying to understand more about what they're wanting to do.
Okay.
This issue goes back to when I was on the city council. Right. We've had studies about the best way to alleviate traffic, the best way to get people to and from. My concern is, well, first of all, I think it's essential to the growth of a city, to the growth of any metropolitan city.
Right.
you can throw out this the world-class status. That's all well and good. I'm not sure exactly what that means, and I'm not sure if the people that use that term know exactly what that means.
Right.
All I know is that we have Indigo and we have some issues with Indigo.
Mm-hmm.
So if we're going to do something, we got to make sure we do it right.
Mm-hmm.
I am gravitating more towards a bus rapid transit mm-hmm. type of system as opposed to rail.
Yeah. Like the bus lanes, bus corridor type of thing.
You get more flexibility. So if the planners decide they're going to go from point A to point B and the ridership isn't there,
mm-hmm.
they can pick the buses up, pave another lane, and move it to point C and D mm-hmm. if that makes more sense.
Mm-hmm.
The rail is a long-term, permanent structure,
yeah.
and it's expensive to build. It's expensive to maintain. And if we don't do it right, we could saddle the city with a lot of debt for our generations to come. So I gravitate more towards the mm-hmm. flexibility that you get with bus. It's cheaper. It's cheaper to maintain. And, you can move with the population shifts or create the population shifts with the bus lines that you put in.
Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, and I was just going to get to the second half of the question, which was the referendum.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a little skeptical on the referendum,
mm-hmm.
Simply because I'm not sure. I've got questions about whether or not it's going to be a fair fight.
Mm-hmm.
When you have advocates that have a line item on their budget and some of it's taxpayer money that they can then go out and say, we're going to use taxpayer money to ask the taxpayers to give us more money. So it's an organized effort in order to, but
if that's your concern, why wouldn't the same rules that bind school corporations in their referendum, in the way the legislature crafted the law, was that schools could not use any of money they get from the state, money that they get from the property tax levies,
mm-hmm.
School employees mm-hmm. cannot lobby. And school board members, which I think is the one flaw of the law, since they are the policy makers, mm-hmm. they can't even advocate, which would be the equivalent of telling the legislature you can't go out and advocate for or against a piece of legislation that you voted on in the legislature under that. But that's neither here nor there. So why wouldn't the same rules, if we had a mass transit referendum, use the school rules?
Yeah, no, that's exactly my point. Mm-hmm. I think they should use the same rules as either. You know, there are two different referendums for school. One is operating, one is capital.
Mm-hmm.
One can use doesn't fall under that category. The other one does.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think in order for it to be a fair fight, you have those ground rules for everybody, and I think that's just the fair way to do it.
On education, we did a broadcast earlier this calendar year in the Washington Township schools. You're out in Lawrence, the middle of. August, and obviously, the money that they were shorted, because as money is less, it's less coming in. This the state was trying to deal with their money issues. Hamilton Southeastern, I think the whole community knows, fastest growing school, and they're multi-million dollars behind. We've made a lot of changes in education the last several years. Are we at a point where we need to take a breath and let the changes be absorbed, sort of like let the meat marinate before the legislature even thinks of any more reform?
It's a great question, and it's been asked before. I think the answer is yes and no,
mm-hmm.
because we don't want to stop the momentum that I think we have. And I just came from a panel discussion about the impact that charter schools are having on families that had really no other opportunity, no other option to send their kid to a working school, mm-hmm. the school that works best for them.
Right.
And this is one of those issues that this cuts racial lines, mm-hmm. this cuts party lines, this cuts socioeconomic lines to some degree. And that is when you have somebody that has they're in a failing school district.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have the means to move to a better school district. They don't have the means to send their child to a private school. What do they do? Mm-hmm. They're stuck. And we, as a state, are complicit in not providing a quality education for them. In the state of Indiana, if a traditional public school is failing, we give them 6 years So if your son or daughter is in first grade in a failing school district, they're going to experience that failing school district for 6 years. Mm-hmm. I'm a big advocate of charter schools. I think they give families options where they may never have gotten an option before.
Right.
We have a lot of specialty charter schools. We have online charter schools where kids have reported kids with disabilities can learn from home. These charter schools are giving parents options. So having said that, I don't want to go back on that. I don't want to lose that momentum. On the other hand, every time we pass legislation, there's going to be things that we miss. We don't have a crystal ball, and there are things that people that might slip through the cracks and not fit into the outcome may not fit into the outcome that we think they're going to receive. And we've got to come back and do that. And I have, as a member of the Senate Ed Committee, that's one of the things that we do often is we'll look at, we passed X last year. Right. It's not working, or there are certain aspects of it that aren't working. We need to bring in all the stakeholders, listen to what they have to say, and find the best solution. Right. But to say a moratorium on anything, I would say no, I don't want to do that.
Need to be concerned that we've got a few charter schools that have been open now going into their fifth or sixth year that aren't setting the world on fire. Mm-hmm. You know, there's two here in Marion County, Imagine Schools, that are all that were 4 years on the bad list. And we're just waiting to see what the letter grade will be. If it's an F, then that's 5 years in a row. And Ball State, which is the chartering entity, has been reluctant to put the hook on any of their charter schools, whereas the mayor's office here, both under Bart Peterson and under Greg Ballard, have pulled the hook on schools for noncompliance, malfeasance, call it what you will. Does the legislature need to look at Ball State and these other authorizers and say, wait a minute, what are y'all doing? Because now the state has its own chartering thing, and obviously it's a brand new thing, so it's got to take 2 to 3 years to really see what's going to go on there.
Well, they have to have accountability, and charter schools will only work if there is strict accountability. Mm-hmm. And the sheer fact that you have some of these schools that have their charters revoked, I think, is an indication that it is working.
Right.
And they've had them revoked in a much shorter time span than a 6 year period that we're giving traditional public schools. And that's a testament to the system working, in my opinion. But what we have found is that a particular school might have been authorized by entity X. That was revoked. Now they go sort of shopping for the next authorizer that might be willing to keep them open. That's not the intent of what we put together. It's not part of the framework that we envisioned, and so a prime example of going back and sort of fixing something needs to be fixed.
Well, now, using that same example, does the legislature need to, and if you're reelected, need to look at what happened with
Project School?
Yeah, the Project School. In other words, a decision was made, but here you are 2 weeks before school starts, and you got parents scrambling, and an argument could be made. You know, if you're going to make a decision, make it within enough time that it's X, unless it is some life and death emergency, which was Stonegate, you know, allegedly had financial, and they pulled that plug at the end of a semester. Same problem.
Oh, you know, I spent about a half hour on the front porch of a single mother in my district who was in exactly that situation with exactly the school that we were talking about, 2.5 weeks before school starts, and she's left holding the bag, not knowing where to send her child, not knowing whether or not this school's going to, you know, go through a lawsuit or an injunction or whatever. That's exactly the point is if the charter is revoked, but that whole issue was terribly handled. But if a charter is revoked, we have to have a plan in place. And those are some of the tweaks that we're talking about.
239-1310, 239-1310's afternoon's name is. Let me go to Larry. Hi there.
Hi, Amos.
Hi.
You know, Scott, it's so simple to find out what we suffered and what we came up with, a plan for our common school system here in the state of Indiana, which have been partially destroyed by property tax caps, by just taking off this tax on the property of corporations. So what makes you think that you can have a charter school that cannot demand their money from the legislature. In fact, they're at the mercy of the legislature and at the mercy of these corporations for funding, and also the dangerous pathway that we take when we allow the mayor to charter schools, and eventually the General Assembly is shirking more of their responsibility towards schools. So I see in another couple of years, in fact, there was some legislation last year in the General Assembly to transfer those dollars to the mayor's office and let him administer those funds. Now, the mayor's administering public safety. He's administering the fire department here in our town, and our IMPD, our public safety, which you're familiar with from the council. Now these operations are operating on short-term payday loans. So what makes you think that a charter school is going to be successful when you have a situation where you're not paying your teachers, when you don't have a unified system, which is called for in our Constitution? You know, Amos, I get so sick and tired of these candidates coming on talking about they support things that are outside of the scope of their business. They are supposed to be obedient to the Constitution, and the only thing that it specifies is a uniform system of common schools. It also establishes the funding for these schools, which has been really abused. And, Scott, how can you even sit up there and talk about charter schools? I wonder why.
Let me let the senator respond. I think Larry's getting more conservative in his young age, Senator.
No, I would disagree with Larry. I am happy to stand up here as an advocate for charter schools because of the opportunities and the choices that they have given to families that had no other opportunities. And when you see some kids that have succeeded and excelled in an environment where they couldn't excel before, then to me that's all worth it. And it's very gratifying to see that happen. You know, charter schools are not the silver bullet. Nobody said they were. It's just another option for parents. And the beauty about charter schools is they have to provide the building. It's not a public building. They have to provide transportation. It's not it's outside of what their budget line item is. Those are all over and above what traditional public schools offer. And so they're already behind the eight ball. And then as funding follows a student, they get actually less per pupil to operate and to educate that child than does a traditional school. In fact, the money you were talking about, the money, Larry, that money that follows a student, a good portion of it goes to the traditional public school for not educating that child that's not there. And so when you have a charter school that is well run and fully accountable, parents have choices and kids are educated.
All right, 239-1310, 239-1310 is afternoon's name. We'll take a break. And when we come back, we'll talk with Senator Scott Schneider more about education, about is there, you know, what do we do with the cost of corrections? Is there a way we can reduce the cost of corrections, keep neighborhoods safe, and maybe take some money from this, you know, just lower the state budget? I'm trying to help him. I'm trying to be more fiscally responsible here. It's afternoons with Avis after these. We're back with Senator Scott Schneider. Republican incumbent in State Senate District 30. Is there, if you're reelected, is there any desire in this legislature to try to figure out alternative sentencing for nonviolent offenders to try to reduce the cost of correction in the state? Or is this one of those issues where it's nice, but the practical reality is the legislature's not going to vote for that?
Well, that's a good question. Not serving on the criminal code and judiciary committees, I haven't heard a whole lot of discussion. I know we are having a comprehensive look at criminal code in Indiana.
To see what's working, exactly. What makes sense, take the dead wood out.
Yep, something that hasn't happened, I think, in 10 to 15 years, mm-hmm. according to the folks that are heading that up. So I think that's going to be a positive step. But you know, going back to crime, and we touched on that in the earlier question. You have the short term, immediate impact that you can have with, getting officers away from the desk and get them out on the road patrol. You can have long term impact on improving education, right. Getting kids off the streets, improving the economy, which decreases the need to go out and, you know, try to survive during with other means.
Right.
A good economy does not solve crime, but it goes a long way.
Mm-hmm.
And those types of things. And then you've got, you know, cultural issues, things that no matter what government does, you know, you're still not going to change the heart of a person in mm-hmm. many respects. You can throw as much money, you can put as many programs out there as you want, but some things are just culturally based, societally based issues that I'm not sure government even has the means to ever correct.
Let me go to Anonymous at 239-1310. Hi there.
Hi. I guess I got in kind of like on the end, but I just wanted to know, what did he think about, you know, kids having like behavior issues, but they are exceeding academically, but a teacher suggests special education for them.
So the kids that have behavioral issues,
yep.
They're getting the education.
They're getting academically, they're, you know, straight A student, but they have behavioral issues, but the teachers are wanting to put them into like special education, because I thought special education was for a learning disability.
It is.
So why would a teacher suggest? I'm just want to hear his views on that.
Well, first, yeah, I'm gonna let the senator, since he's on the education committee, and special education and misinformation or schools giving parents the wrong information is one of the things we hear on this program a lot, because special education, which, you know, has money from the federal government, mm-hmm. Is supposed to be for students who have some kind of learning disability or disorder or a physical handicap or disability, for that school to create a plan on how that kid's going to get an education.
Yeah.
So they can't use it for behavioral.
Only for academic is what you're saying?
No,
what is your understanding? I don't believe it can be used for behavioral.
That's what I'm saying. Academically, they're exceeding that. They're very capable of learning. They're a straight A student. However, they have like behavior issues, like sitting down in their seat, not talking in class,
okay.
Little simple things like that.
What grade is this young person in?
They're in third.
Third grade? High, male or female?
Female.
Okay, that's a little so hyperactive, and they've not asked for that child to be tested.
No.
Okay.
Today, the special education. I'm thinking that's a learning disability. I thought, but maybe.
No. Your mother wit and your gut is telling you right. One,
that's right.
They before they can even label a child special ed, there must be a they must be tested.
But there wouldn't be no need to be tested if
they're not tested necessarily for academics. They're tested for aptitude.
Okay.
In other words, aptitude skills, like your reading skills, your visual skills. What's the other word? Acuity skills. Not so much math and English and stuff, but just the basic skills of learning. It's like an IQ test, and there's some other tests that they do. That's step one.
That's not what they do with the NWEA testing. Is that something?
No, that's something different.
Okay.
Then step two, after they do the testing, then there's a big meeting with the special ed teacher, the classroom teacher, the principal, and your entire family, mm-hmm. Mom, dad, grandma, grandpa. You know, if you got a faith leader, they can come to the meeting, and all of you together devise a plan to educate the child.
So they're not trying to do that. They're just calling me every day. And
have you had a meeting with the principal?
I think he's a vice principal.
No, forget the vice. Go to the head guy. What district is this?
It's IPS. It's Indiana Math Academy.
Wait a minute. Indiana Math Academy?
North.
On 71st and Keystone?
Mm-hmm.
Guess what?
That's a charter school.
Okay,
so the same. I'm glad you called when the senator's here, because he can hear how some of his legislation ain't working.
Mm-hmm.
Step one, you have a meeting with the school leader.
Right.
Okay.
If that don't work out, you request to meet with the board, or you go to the next board meeting. The board meetings of Math and Science North are public meetings. If you go to their website, under a change in state law, they must have on their website the names and, I believe, contact information for all the board members.
Okay.
And then, let's see, math and science, I believe, is a mayor's charter school. You can complain to the mayor's charter school office.
So they can't actually put her in there without me agreeing.
Absolutely.
Okay. You hit it right on the nail on the head. That's exactly right. Parental involvement is critical. Yeah, parental involvement. And let's keep in mind, charter schools are public schools. And we saw a couple of deficiencies there. Prime example, public meetings, making sure that the board members are the board meetings are publicized, making sure that all of the contact information is there, that parents in your particular case have an opportunity, not only an opportunity, but the exposure to go to the right place and request those meetings and talk to school leaders, talk to board members, and then if all else fails, you go back to the authorizer. That's the city of Indianapolis, and they have I don't have his name in front of me, but there's a deputy
Jason,
mayor.
Jason Clough.
Yeah, deputy mayor of charter schools. Call his office if you don't get any regress from the school itself. And, I mean, there's several steps along the way that you can go, but I would – Amos is exactly right. Go to the school leader right now.
And, ma'am, the other thing is you ask someone in the school office – are they a Title I school?
Yeah, they are.
Oh, well, then all the special ed rules apply. So for that teacher, who told you that it was special ed?
What teacher?
Okay, the teacher told you a fib.
Yeah, she mentioned that. She said, well I'm going to think it may be special ed. We're going to pull out the special ed education teacher and have her talk to her. And I'm thinking, oh, they're going to try to label her is what they
No, say. No. Then you go back to the teacher and say, you know, I was listening to the radio to the guy on the radio. He was talking to a state senator on the Senate Education Committee. They're the ones that write the laws, y'all. and you simply say, special ed, then I want a meeting. I want a, here's the language, case conference.
Okay.
You want a case conference. If they're talking special ed, you got to talk case conference. And in the case conference, they got a test and they have to create an IEP. That's an individualized education plan,
okay,
on how they're going to educate that young lady. Don't let them try to medicate without your doctor signing off on it.
Amen to that.
Oh, we've got common ground here.
That's
See,
right.
Senator, you Senator don't believe in just giving somebody some drugs just to give them drugs, okay?
Right. Okay.
All right, good luck to you.
Thanks.
One of the criticisms of charter schools has been that they didn't understand the rules on special education, that they didn't have the teachers or the staff or the training or understand that if that school, Math and Science North, can't provide the services, all they got to do is call the Washington Township Schools. That's the district of record. Mm-hmm. And Washington Township, by law, under Title I, has to provide the services.
Absolutely. Back to my original point, keep in mind, charter schools are public schools. They're just funded differently. There are different structures. But if you are a Washington Township resident and you want to send your kid to a charter school, they have to take all comers. And they take them in a first-come, first-served basis. There's no selectivity there.
I asked this with the previous panel. We have, when you go to vote, a big poster that says Bill of Rights for Voters. That explains what your rights and responsibilities are as when you go and vote. Mm-hmm. And I believe that passed by a bipartisan margin back in the day.
Yeah.
Do we need something now in Indiana with all of these school options, a bill of rights and responsibilities for parents and guardians where the rights are spelled out as to what a parent's right are in school and their responsibilities, like you better make sure that kid is there. You got to make sure that they're educated until they're age X.
I think that'd be a great idea. I think that'd be a great bipartisan effort between you and me. We can make this happen.
Because we deal so much. I mean, here's the lady that did not know what her rights were under the law of special education. Mm-hmm. I still have listeners that think a charter school is a private school,
right,
not a public school.
Still get that a lot. Absolutely. No, and you had mentioned one of – I think it was the same bill that charter schools are mandated to have transparency in their meetings.
Right.
There's also a lot of that information on the DOE, the Department of Education, State of Indiana Department of Education website.
Mm-hmm.
You'll have a lot of that information on there, and more and more and more is coming. But I'm with you. Look, this is as Larry said, this is mandated by the Constitution of Indiana.
Right.
We have got to provide a quality education for all kids. And any time that we can break any barrier of understanding of options that are available to all parents out there,
mm-hmm.
that's a good thing, and it needs to be done. And if it's whether it's a website, whether it's a poster, whether it's a flyer or mail or something, but getting that information into the hands of parents is a good thing.
Let me go to another anonymous at 239-1310. Hi there.
Hey, how's it going?
Fine.
Hey, I want to ask a question.
Yeah.
Because I noticed in the city, we tear down a lot of houses, and that's not helped with property taxes. I'm going back to what Larry said. How can we get corporations to get back on the tax roll to help taxpayers? I'm talking about dealing with corporation profit and nonprofit. We got too many nonprofit corporations got a lot of land and not paying their property taxes. And I'm thinking, somehow, I don't know how we're going to do it, but they need to start paying property taxes just like everybody else.
But, right, yeah, you know, one of the problems that we faced when I was on the city council is if you look at the core center, the mile square of Indianapolis, I think the percentage was over 50% of those properties, whether it's a federal building, a state building, a college or university, or a non-for-profit, did not pay property taxes, yet we have to maintain infrastructure. We have to maintain public safety for all of those structures and buildings. And so we looked at, and under Mayor Peterson,
right.
We looked at a pilot payment in lieu of taxes,
mm-hmm.
to sort of offset that deficiency between the lack of revenue from property taxes and the services that we're providing. Now, if a corporation moves out of a building, they still have to pay property tax on that building,
right.
and that property. And that hasn't changed. That doesn't change.
I appreciate it. 239-1310. 239-1310. It's Afternoons with Amos. Let me go to the phones. And another three anonymouses in a row. Hi there.
Hello.
Hi. You're on the air.
Yes. I have a comment.
Yes, ma'am.
I am a former teacher. 35 years, been out of the school system for 2 years, so I haven't been out very long. Administrators, leaders, and other folks that are making decisions for education have no idea what's going on in our public schools. First of all, teachers are not just throwing kids in special ed classes. They have to be tested by their family doctor, or they can be provided a reference for a doctor. And the comment the lady had before about her child being in a behavior class, behavior is considered a disability because it keeps them from learning. But the main problems with our school system is, one, parent accountability, and two, our children are out of control. And that's all I have to say.
All right. Appreciate it. 239-1310. 239-1310. It's Afternoons with Amos. We'll take a break. We'll be back with our remaining moments with Senator Scott Schneider. Council District 30.
Senate District.
you kept
old
saying councils. Old habits die hard.
Right.
Afternoons with Amos after these.
Yep.
Welcome back. 239-1310. 239-1310. It's Afternoons with Amos. During the break, we were talking about Scott Schneider, a father who served on the City County Council for many years, who is conservative, fiscally conservative, who probably didn't like TIF districts. may have to bring him back to provide some wisdom and guidance. As you've gone out in the district, you know, folks coming out to vote?
Yeah, I think they're very concerned all across the board. You know, they're looking at leadership from a presidential standpoint,
mm-hmm.
Congress.
Mm-hmm.
Congress's approval rating is at an all-time low.
Mm-hmm.
I won't tell you some of the choice words that I get from folks in D.C., both on both sides of the aisle.
Mm-hmm.
The bottom line is people want government to work and
mm-hmm.
work for them. They want it to essentially provide the constitutional services that are required by government. And then, you know, from the rest of the standpoint, just kind of, you know, get out of the way and don't be a hindrance to progress.
There's been talk from the Republican candidate for governor, Mike Pence, about families. And given that families in Indiana, the majority of all households now are not married couple families. You know, if I were to run the numbers of your district north of 96th Street, you know, the majority of households are married couple families. South of 96th Street, it's totally different. As we look at how state government may look at families, is it time to look at things like grandparents' rights? Is it time to look at how, for dads who want to be involved, you know, dads who are divorced from their wife,
custodial issues,
and dads who want to be involved in the life of their child, and the system forces you to have to move heaven and earth and dig in your pocket just to get what the judge said you were entitled to? I mean, if the next legislature is going to look at family issues, aren't these some of the family issues we really ought to be looking at?
Sure. And I'll give you an example. We talked about grandparents' rights for two years in a row. Something that I thought was somewhat of a given is that, you know, grandparents should be involved, especially in a tough situation at home between the mom and the dad. Mm-hmm. If a grandparent can step in and add stability, that's something I think state government should promote and look for ways to make it happen.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the testimony we got from parents, when you grant that in state government or you codify that into law, then here again that word unintended consequences again. We had testimony of people saying, it's no different than any family that's out there. Whether you have issues between the husband and the wife, you have issues between the wife and the father-in-law or the mother-in-law, those kinds of struggles. And we had people give testimony that, hey, the grandparents came in, they essentially took over, they were very disruptive in the child's upbringing as opposed to stability. So when you look at all of the different issues out there from a family standpoint, I think government needs to do things that are virtuous, that can help sustain a family, but not do things that would be harmful.
If people want more, standard closing question with all of our candidates, if people want more information about your campaign, Scott Schneider, Republican running for re-election in Senate District 30, how do they get a hold of you?
Just go to my website, Schneider, S-C-H-N-E-I-D-E-R, Schneider4Senate.com.
Schneider, 4 Senate, the number 4?
No, the word.
The word, F-O-R, for Senate.com. Senator Scott Schneider, thanks very much for being with us.